Hello and welcome to Focus, the Catholic Answers podcast for living, understanding, and defending your Catholic faith. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. And this time, we talk with Tom Nash, who is theologian here at he's been an important theologian in Catholic media for a long time, including at EWTN and at various Catholic radio stations. And now he's extremely helpful in answering questions individually here at Catholic Answers. Tom Nash is, in addition to being all those things, he is a fan of one movie above all other movies. And it just so happens that this is the perfect time of year to talk about that movie. It is The Exorcist. It's the 50th anniversary of The Exorcist. Tom Nash, thank you for being here with us.
Thank you very much. May I make one brief disclaimer?
Yes.
That is, my favorite movie is A Man for All Seasons with Paul Scofield. But I do like this movie, minus a particular edit regarding a crucifix. But I do think it's a very powerful, helpful movie.
Well, and this is the perfect time of year to talk about The Exorcist, and there's a kind of a sequel-ish type of thing. I don't know if it's a direct sequel, but they're promoting it as a sequel to The Exorcist coming out now. And what I wanted to ask you about is, you know, you could watch this movie without religious faith, I feel like, and enjoy it in the same way that you could read, say, The Lord of the Rings without religious faith and enjoy it. But your enjoyment will be increased if you understand just how Catholic it is in either of those cases.
You're speaking about the original or the new one?
The original.
The original, yes. I think so, too. A lot of people have found it powerful because it is realistic. They go through, as is done in a real exorcism case, they look for psychological, psychiatric explanations as to why a person is behaving so erratically. And the acting is great. The music, they won an Academy Award for sound. Mercedes McCambridge as the voice of the devil. There's just many things that come together to make this movie very strong.
Oh, I'm sorry. Did something interrupt you, Tom? I apologize.
Yes, that would be Tubular Bells by Mr. Oldfeld.
Yeah, which is ruined now because you always think there's a demon coming if Tubular Bells starts playing. Not eerie music, but used to eerie effect.
It is, and I think the thing too is the fact that it is eerie and the people, oh my gosh, the devil is real. It should be a reminder, okay, sometimes people come to realize or believe in the existence of God by realizing the existence of evil spirits. And we see this in the movie. The mother of the child, Reagan is her name, no relation to the former president, R-E-G-A-N, played by Linda Blair. She is playing with a Ouija board, which is a form of spiritism and therefore is not recommended. Divination, where you're trying to contact spirits and trying to find out the future or trying to find out things with regard to your own life. Well, when you play the Ouija board, which is one of those things condemned by the Catechism in 2115 to 2117, you're going to be, it's not the communion of saints you're going to be connecting with. It's the demonic world. And that's what happens to this young lady. Now, the mother thinks that everything, what's going on with her daughter? Yeah, you know, she sees the bed is going up and down, and thinking she's trying to talk to the doctor. And the doctor says, Mrs. McNeil, the problem isn't with your daughter's bed, it's her brain. And so they continue to go through thing after thing after thing, and nothing's working. All these scans, nothing is happening. And then they finally come to the point to ask her, well, do you have any religious beliefs? And she says, no. And her daughter, no. And then they start talking about how that the Catholic Church keeps this thing called exorcism in the closet, kind of like as an embarrassment of sorts. And so he said, but it's the power of believing in the exorcism that causes this possession-like state. And then as a result, the victim's belief in possession is what helped cause it, is what the doctor says. So in that same way, a belief in the power of exorcism can make it disappear. And he prefaces it by saying, well, the Catholics keep it in a closet as sort of an embarrassment, but it has worked, not for the reasons they think, of course.
Right, of course.
Then he goes on, but then she perfectly, as an agnostic atheist herself, looks at him and says, so you're telling me that I should take my daughter to a witch doctor. Is that it? And she, and then the dumbfounded look and embarrassed look on the doctor is just priceless, because it really is telling, because he can't come up with any explanations medically. And then he tries to mock what it could be. And then she comes back and calls him on it because she doesn't believe that, at least at that point in the movie. So I think it's really the fact that they go through this process, gives it more credibility, because that's exactly what the Catholic Church does in an exorcism case.
Which is fascinating, because there's a certain kind of derision in the characters, not in the script, because the writer's view is different than the character's view, but the characters would deride religious faith as effective. But the church doesn't take offense at that. The church would say, look into everything before you think this is a demon. But I'll be, and so that's perfect. But that derision, I think, is actually internalized by many Christians. And here's my point, Tom. Sometimes you hear people talk about the exorcisms that Christ himself did, because Christ, of course, was the most powerful exorcist. And he's depicted as an exorcist again and again and again in the Gospels. And they'll say, well, you know, it was called exorcism in those days, but he was healing those people of a mental illness, or he was healing them of a trauma or something like that. And that's what it is. But the gospel is actually quite clear that healing is a different thing than exorcism. He does heal people constantly, but it doesn't confuse healing and exorcism. It says they're two different things.
Yes, it's quite clear that possession is an invading spirit, a fallen angelic spirit. Fallen angelic spirit, typically. And, you know, these people know who Jesus is. You know, they say every knee will bend, every tongue confess, and even the demons know or believe in God. Of course, they don't have the faith and trust, etc., and that's why they're demons. But yes, it's quite different. And even the priest in the movie, which I think is well done, William Peter Blatty's book, Taken to a Screenplay, and he won Best Adapted Screenplay, the Academy Awards for movies that came out in 1973. The awards were in early 74, I think March at the time. But he himself, being a trained psychiatrist, he says, you know, I've gone into places like Harvard, Bellevue, Johns Hopkins, places like that, as he says in the movie. He is very reluctant to believe, and he wants, you know, he says, hey, I've had people tell that they're Napoleon Bonaparte. So I'm very, very much doubtful about this. And yet he says, at one point, show me Reagan and I'll believe. And then he turns his back. And earlier he had had, while he's visiting his sick mother who lived in Little Italy in New York City, he is on a subway platform at night by himself. And there is a homeless man. And in a New York accent, says, "Father, can you help an old altar boy?" And then they look towards him and they go, "I'm a Catholic." And then the light from the passing train flashes on his face, and Father Karras ignores him and goes his way, either to get the train or to go off the to catch the train, because he was coming up the subway platform. But then that same voice in those exact same words are said, and this is part of the thing of one of the signs of an exorcism, not besides studying languages, levitation could be existence, sustained strength, aversion to objects, potentially moving objects, also clairvoyance. And so it's being communicated to him directly, Cy, if you will, that you think this is just a mental illness case. You're wrong, my friend. And the fact is, you know that you were the only person on that subway platform when you ran into that guy, and only you heard what he said. And now you're hearing the same words in the same voice. And even then, he says, because he's still reluctant, because he tries some holy water and she gets upset, and he says that's not a good sign. But there's various things that are contributing that eventually he's wondering about it, and she eventually tells him that she killed Burke Dennings, and Burke Dennings was a friend of McNeil, Mrs. McNeil, in the movie, Ellen Burstyn's character. And because she went in one time and saw her daughter, that's where the whole twisting of the head, turning around scene, but talks to her, the demon talks to her in the voice of Burke Dennings, and he goes, "Do you know what your daughter did to me, et cetera, et cetera." In other words, so that people were wondering how Burke Dennings got pushed out the window and how he fell and how his head got turned backwards and all the rest of that. And it was because he was killed by somebody. Now the detective thinks somebody else was in the movie and killed in the movie in the room and killed her and threw him out, pushed him out the window. But indeed, it was Reagan, but being possessed by an evil spirit. And so Chris McNeil, the mother, is explaining that to father. And then father at one point is having, he goes, does your, you know, your, he asks a few questions there about, at the end, he's wondering, he goes, did you know that my mother died? And she says, yes. He goes, did Reagan know? No, because she also speaks to him in his mother's voice, and he playing on his guilt. It's kind of like I say, the screw tape letters in a sense of a cinematic analog, because the demon speaks in the voice of his mother, and he felt guilty because he was a psychiatrist. But instead of being on Park Avenue, he takes a vow of poverty, chastity, obedience with the Jesuits. So when his mother dies in an insane asylum, and they show that where he visits her, and why'd you do this to me, Demi? I should be at home, Demi, and all that. His name is Father Damien Karras. He's feeling the devil is playing on his weakness. That is that he feels guilty about how his mom died and what happened. And so talking, recreating that voice and getting mad at him is the perfect way to get on. It's like, okay, now you believe. Well, now I'm going to try a different tactic on you. You're guilty because your mother died because of you. And so then when he asks, he goes, because he hears this and he's going out the door at the McNeil residence and said, did you know that my mother died? Yes, I did. No. Did Reagan know? No, not at all. And she says, why? He goes, it's not important.
Yeah.
So the things are building up in the case. And so the psychiatrist, as I like to say, the subplot of the whole movie is, besides the larger battle of good versus evil side, is that you have the psychiatrist priest who's gone away. And earlier in the movie, he tells one of his Jesuit confreres that he thinks he's lost his faith. And then you have this woman who is an agnostic atheist who's moving. She, because of what's going on and seeing everything with her daughter, nothing being able to fix it. They're moving in different directions and they kind of meet in the middle, and it's God's grace, she moves him back toward belief, because he eventually, along with an older priest played by Max von Sydow, helps with the exorcism.
Well, before we get to that, I want to ask you this about this, the use of the horror motif kind of here as a way of confronting the viewer of the movie. Because here's a movie that comes out in the early 1970s, a profoundly secular time. The world has gone through the kind of secularizing 60s, where there's obviously a tremendous loss of faith. Well, also, I mean, that loss of faith had been going on for a good long while, but there's this kind of descending secularism. It's descending upon the entire culture. It's certainly the main mode that you'll find in the media of the early 1970s on television or whatnot. You won't find religion depicted at all, really, on television in the 1970s.
Not too much.
So what I want to ask you is, so the viewer is watching this. It seems like both Blatty, the writer, and Friedkin, the director, are using the horror mode to challenge the secular by saying, isn't there something eerie about the world? There's something deeper about this world than the secular explanations.
Yes, and it's based upon, loosely, a real story that goes back to when Blatty was a student at Georgetown back in the late 40s. A case involved a Lutheran teenager or adolescent, maybe he was 12 at the time when it started, but eventually that case was dealt with in St. Louis by the Jesuits there. I think there still was vestiges of belief, right? Even amongst that younger adult generation that came of age, if you will, in a secular sense, the late 60s, early 70s, they are still schooled in a belief. And this kind of hits on that. We're much more even secular today than we were then. And I've always thought of it, because I'm not a big horror fan. I don't go to these slash movies and other gratuitous violence kind of stuff. I'm not into that at all. I've always saw this as a journey of faith, as a story of faith. And I was pleased to hear and doing research on the movie over the years, Cy, that that's what Blatty thought, and Friedkin. Friedkin was the perfect person to do it, because we see some of these movies today, often by well-meaning Christian people, where they try to show by telling, you know, explain it, and as people might say, beat them over the head so that they make sure that this is the message of this Christian movie. And yet Blatty and Friedkin, Friedkin in particular, as the director, does so well, because so much of what he's showing is the visuals of what's going on with this person. It's not a lecture. In fact, they're mocking faith, but they're showing this isn't coming up with any mere medical explanation as to why this girl is in trouble. And you see these preternatural, you know, going beyond what would be a natural cause, showing evidence of the demonic, that there are spirits involved. And it just little by little makes the case in a way that is compelling and that is disturbing. And so I think enough vestiges of faith that were still there, and it was done so well that it really struck a chord, such that it became, including with the re-release in 1998, 20th anniversary, it's one of the all-time adjusted gross box office hits.
The crucifix plays a role, a grotesque role in some points, but obviously not only a grotesque role. You think about in vampire movies the role of the crucifix, and you think of the criticism that Catholics get from some fellow Christians about having the corpus on the cross. They just want to see the cross and not the body of Christ on the cross. But it does seem to me that there's something here that is... that in a situation in which there are, principalities and powers at work in the world that Friedkin and Blatty are trying to point us to, a bare cross would not have had the power. In a certain sense, Tom, I would say this, like as an image, the crucifix itself points to a dimension of life that is a bit horrifying and challenging and forces the imagination to confront a kind of violence underneath all of this that we don't usually want to look at. As a matter of fact, we never want to look at. And so the Christian symbol, or I should say Catholic symbolism, rosary beads and holy water and crucifixes and Bibles, these play an important role in the imagery that Friedkin provides us.
Yes, and I think it's like St. Paul says, and people will say, even our brothers and sisters who are Protestant will say, what are you guys with, you know, Jesus overcame it. It's like, well, yeah, Jesus did overcome it, and yet the battle goes on until the second coming, you know, that he says, St. Paul says, we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews and a folly to Gentiles, 1 Corinthians 1. Verse 23. And as well, he goes on into the next passage, into the next chapter of 1 Corinthians, and he says, I did not come proclaiming to you testimony of God and lofty words of wisdom, for I decided to know nothing among you except Jesus Christ and him crucified. So it is St. Paul, of all people, who is reminding us that the crucifix should be above the cross. And as you said as well, Cy, that it is an image to show that there is evil in the world and Christ died, the fittingness of how he dies to show the ugliness of sin, of our own sin and the world's sin, but as well as going against this battle on a higher level. As you mentioned, powers and principalities, Ephesians 6:12 says we have a battle not against flesh and blood. It's ultimately with principalities and powers, you know, recognizing the level, the choirs of angels. And he says, you know, the rulers of this present darkness, the spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places. So we, St. Paul there, not just 1 Corinthians 1, talking about the importance of the crucifix, and the power of the good over evil, Christ destroying death and the devil and sin, but as well making it very clear that as much as we might see enemies being presidents or governors or attorneys generals, it's a bigger battle that's going on.
How do you deal with a movie that obviously does such a great job of portraying the role of the Catholic Church as, in a sense, the exorcist for the whole world? Sanctifying the world means driving the demons out, and that's what the church does. It sanctifies the world. And so what do you think of a movie that does that so well? But there are images in the movie that really a Catholic should not look at. I mean, they're not appropriate for, I hate the word appropriate, but they're not healthy or wholesome enough, or they're not morally acceptable. Let me put it that way.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And I hear you on that. And there's certain things where a disfiguring of a statue of the Blessed Mother in Dahlgren Chapel, which is on the campus of Georgetown University. I guess it's another expression. And if I were being the editor, I would, and when I do watch it, I edit some things out if it's something where I'm showing in the video. But I do think it also shows the ugliness of the devil and the ugliness to which he will go to destroy. And people don't realize it. And sometimes the visuals, one might agree, disagree about that. And I have some reservations. Like I said, the crucifix scene, I would get rid of it. But on the other hand, it shows the vileness and the just utter opposition to Christ and his kingdom, and therefore us, and therefore wanting us to be in hell with him, and to do anything and everything to do it. And that, you know, some of those visuals show that.
And evil is degrading. So it does seem to me important that the victim here is a little girl. I've spoken to exorcists who say, you know, it's virtually impossible to exorcise someone who does not want to be. And this is something that people don't want to know about, is that there are people who are possessed by demons and don't want the demons to go away, and want to remain in the company of those demons. So having a little child as the victim, the aspect of repentance and accepting help is not quite as prevalent as it would have been had it been an adult.
Yeah, but it's a good point you mentioned, that there's a free will aspect here, and the person needs to, even though the person who's possessed doesn't have control over their body, they still have control over their soul, and they can turn around and turn away. And it's because of her divination, playing with the Ouija board, that she got in trouble to begin with. And so it's going to be that same thing. And that's what I like about the movie, spoiler alert, 50 years later, is that then when I talk about telling by showing, that Friedkin at the end, Chris McNeil, Ellen Burstyn's character, says she doesn't remember anything at all from, because after the
exorcism. The child doesn't, yeah.
Yeah, and then she comes out and she says, oh, this is Father so-and-so. Oh, hello, Father. And then they zoom in on his collar. And it's a very just close-up on that. And then show her, and then she kisses him and gives him a big hug and kisses him on the cheek. And he's a little taken aback. And you could just tell that she's expressing that somebody with a collar, she understands that somebody dressed like that helped me. I don't understand all, but you can see that she is grateful and yet not completely clear about what happened, but yet she's grateful. And it just shows how you can communicate the faith, or communicate a belief in the power of exorcism, the God-given power of the church to exorcise demons, by her reaction. There's no need for dialogue because the visuals say it all.
Now you say, despite the fact that we never see Mercedes McCambridge anywhere in this movie, that she made the film.
I would say so, because she's got a voice you might say is androgynous. I know as a kid at some of the the monsters that scared me most were like Medusa or this woman who was kind of a female monster. And there's something that's almost like an attack, as we see on creation, on identity. It's neither male nor female, as Friedkin says. And there's this kind of, she's not just female that might laugh, but it's, oh my gosh, it's this menacing combination thereof. And plus she did chain smoking. She ate raw eggs, which makes it all the more compelling. And sometimes, as William Friedkin, the director, says, you sometimes get more, you know, two or three sounds coming out of her throat, because she would be restrained physically. So she put herself through a lot with the care of her spiritual director, so that she could be as quote unquote credible as possible. And they did not give her credit in the original. I think this
thing.
No, not at first. And later on in the movie. And so I think people are thinking, you know, what was that? How did they do this? I think all the CG in the world today couldn't duplicate the natural raw scariness of her voice.
Yeah.
Because they tried to achieve it and they couldn't. And this is like, oh my goodness, this is
Well, your mother's in here with us became almost like a, I mean, before we even had the internet, it was a meme. Like people would say it on the schoolyard kind of thing.
Yeah. Or what an excellent day for an exorcism. These various lines.
Right.
You know, can you help an old altar boy? And so, yeah, these, it's just, and he, it hits him and it gets him. And then you have Max von Sydow as the seasoned exorcist, and he's late in life and he's got health problems, but he's not intimidated by the devil. And he also tells Father Karras, who's still thinking, I've noticed three personalities. I like to, he goes, there's only one. Now, one can say that you can have a legion of devils, but he's just pointing out that the real issue here is not that she has split personalities or anything like that, but that this has a demonic cause. And yeah, and she really sells it. The voice, I mean, it just across the board, young and old, male, female, whatever faith, that voice of Mercedes McCambridge, that scary androgynous voice really catches people's attention. And because it sounds intimidating. It's not just, uh-oh, this is a scary voice, but this the way it's menacing, and it's also more menacing because it's that expression of a demon, which therefore makes it much more powerful as opposed to Jack Nicholson of The Shining, who's got an axe but is a mere human being. This is the devil, and uh-oh, you better. But then the great thing about it is that it shows that, as it helps Father Karras realize, oh my gosh, there are such a thing as real, that evil spirits. And that means I have power with God. And ultimately, in his imperfect way, he triumphs over the devil and has a last confession. And it's just beautiful how it shows that the devil, he kind of like the soldier who lands on a grenade sigh and offers himself up. He himself offers himself with regard to this girl. And he gets tossed out the window when he says no. And then he's tossed out the window, but he still... He has a final confession. So the girl is exorcised. He dies in the grace of the church. And despite the eerie music at the end, I disagreed with Peter Blatty, who wanted to say, oh, let's have this discussion between Lieutenant Kinderman and the other priests and how everything's okay. I think you've already shown everything's okay. And but evil still exists, but the girl's been exorcised and Father dies in a state of grace. What more do you need?
But now, there's a slightly controversial about the way Father dies, and that is it suicidal? What has happened here? So give me your take on that.
I would say that, you know, some people might make that argument, but at one point he says, come into me, come into me. And then you see his kind of face turning green, almost like the Incredible Hulk. And then he's going to menace and kill the girl whom he just exorcised. But then he says, no, and he yells, and then at that point, is it suicidal, and is he being tossed out the window, or is in this moment of break, I'm going to say I'm winning, so I'm going to like the of the grenade landing on the grenade.
Yeah.
In any event, he's making sure, however one interprets it,
he's protecting the child.
He's protecting the child. So whether he gets tossed out or whether he, in a moment of strength and moment of faith, he gets control of himself and then sacrifices himself. There's no doubt about who's winning because, again, he is reconciled at the end with the final confession. So I think it just shows the devil did not win because the devil says, okay, I didn't get her. You've beaten me, but I'm going to kill her. I'm going to kill her through you. But no, he wins. And whether you want to say he's tossed out or whether he throws himself out, it's clearly a self-sacrifice so that she might... not that she who has been exorcised is not killed. So however one interprets it, it's quite clear in the movie that they believe that he says no, it's quite clear. And however they want to look at it, whether a self-sacrifice or tossed out the window, it is either against his will by being thrown out, or if he offers himself up in a moment of strength and before the devil can get the upper hand again, it's quite clear that it's a victory of good over evil plus subsequent confession, the final confession.
Now, a slightly obscure point, but the original, but I would like to just discuss this with you to make a point about exorcism. You said the original was about a Lutheran boy the Jesuits, who are Catholic priests, performed an exorcism on.
Yes.
Looking at the movie, one assumes that the child is not baptized. And so I want to ask you about exorcism as... not a sacrament, but as an act of service that the church can perform for anyone, that one does not have to be Catholic to receive this service from Christ and his church.
2 points. The sacraments can be, as you've interviewed Adam Bly, the demonologist who helps. He's a layperson out of the Diocese of Pittsburgh. The sacraments are the greatest defense. Receiving the Eucharist is frequently going to confession, but also yes, that one need not be baptized to be possessed, and one can be baptized and still be possessed. But here it is: the church is helping out. The church, you know, make disciples of all nations to serve the whole world. The church is going to help somebody, whatever their faith background is. If they are being if they have been possessed because of unwitting actions, like we see with the girl playing with the Ouija board, the church is there to help.
And now, Tom, it is 2023. And it's back again.
It is.
There is a sequel to The Exorcist out now. I'd like you just to kind of give us. Have you had a chance? You didn't get to see a preview or anything of the sequel. Have you seen it yet?
I've seen the previews.
Oh, the previews. Okay.
Now the thing about the they're showing the 50th anniversary October 1st and October 4th, and then the following Friday, October 6th, is when it's going to debut Exorcist Believer. And the thing about it is Ellen Burstyn's back. She's got to be in her late 80s, early 90s by now. And she comes in as someone who's going to help out. The problem side is kind of this interreligious, which per se isn't a problem, but it gets a religious indifferentism. Because at one point in the movie, she says, she's telling the people whose children are possessed, exorcism is a ritual. Every religion, every culture, they all use different methods. It's going to take all of them, and which I'm thinking, wait a minute, what is this, like the Avengers, the superheroes of religion are going to have to band together and beat the enemy, the devil, as if the church,
like one of those stickers on the back of the car with all the different religious symbols.
Yeah, yeah,
will, and our super team will come together. Yeah,
yeah. As opposed to, as the movie, the original gets so well, it's the Catholic Church that has been given the power to make disciples of all nations, and is given, not that other people aren't Christians, not that other people don't have a belief in God, but it has the unique power. And exorcism is one of those signs and wonders of Catechism 156, the motives of credibility. When you see an exorcism and you see that all that goes on with it, that is a motive of credibility, as we see in the movie and we see otherwise in real life, that there is such a thing as a devil, and the church has power over it, not through through this human person, not of his own power, but because he is uniquely qualified, being deputized by his bishop to go there and to exorcise this child or adult or whoever it may be over time. And so this is what the sad part is, that the movie, I think an attempt maybe to be all things to all people, is going to undermine and not be as, going to be as compelling.
What in the previews made you think that it's going to be kind of interreligious like this? Was it specifically?
It was precisely when Ellen Burstyn, the character Chris McNeil, is back.
Yeah.
And she says exorcism is a ritual. Every religion, every culture, they all use different methods. And they show people different, non-Christian people, as well as, I think, Pentecostals, etc. And then they talk about the body and the blood, the body and the blood. But it's not at a Catholic mass. It's at a Protestant service where you got a minister in a three-piece suit. So you know it's at best a spiritual a symbolic, maybe a spiritual sense, but not a belief in the body and blood as it is. More of symbolic from a Protestant perspective. But it's all, the point is, she's saying it's going to take all of them, as if somehow we got to come together.
Yeah.
And it's not. And so again, we also see Eucharistic as mere symbol versus real presence. I know there's going to be priests because they show some images in it, but this whole sense of religious indifferentism or trying to beat the devil with a cadre of different groups, that's not how it is in real life. It is, in fact, I mean, God can work through whom he pleases, but it is the Catholic Church which has been given the distinctive power of exorcism through the power of the priesthood, of course, Christ being the one high priest who makes it all possible, because he is the creator, and the devil and his demonic minions, however powerful they may be, they are under him because they are creatures. He is the creator. And that's the thing to remember.
Yeah, right. But Christ does will exorcism. I mean, he does it repeatedly in the Gospels.
Yes, he does.
So this is not something that's foreign, or and it's certainly not something we should be embarrassed about as Catholics. Like you were saying, that attitude of Father Karras is almost one of, and at least initially, of embarrassment that the Church even provides this service. It's a real service. Demons are real. Christ is real. This is a real service.
Kind of in a wrap-up comment, I would say I remember 1990 when Father James LaBarre, the chief exorcist of the Archdiocese in New York, was on, where they had had a presentation of an exorcism, and they were talking about it afterwards. It was on ABC, and there was Father LaBarre, and then they had Father McBrien, who was from Notre Dame, God rest his soul, God have mercy on his soul. He goes, well, I believe in evil, because he says, do you believe in the devil? And he goes, well, I believe in evil, all this, but he's asked me, I believe in a person with a pitchfork and all that, some guy with horns. No, I don't. So in other words, he caricatured it, but what we've seen since then, very much an increase of exorcisms, very much an increase in terms of the number of exorcists that have been trained around the world. Right. So it's kind of like getting the battle's heating up, no pun intended.
Well, I mean, it's one of those things where you would say with Father McBrien, the Church doesn't believe in that kind of devil either. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about an enormously powerful personality that hates God and hates anyone to be near God.
And they're almost like you say, I think there's an embarrassment because we can explain it all. And it's like, unfortunately, some of the people, there's a disbelief, and there's nothing like a real life exorcism to get people's attention. A priest that you and I both like, St. John Vianney, they thought, oh, here's this priest he's popular because he's gone to this backwater town and he's dealing with the devil, and then they all spend a night at his rectory, and literally, as they say, all hell breaks loose, and it's like, oh my goodness, Padre Pio, the devil. Right. When the devil's paying attention to something, that's something. He's a liar, but when he's preoccupied with something, as we see with these two great confessors, that's a backhanded compliment. That confession is a very powerful sacrament, and that the exorcists. Exorcism is a very powerful sacramental that the Church has been given by Jesus Christ, the original exorcist. So the devil knows his enemies, and when he goes against confession or tries to attack confessors, when he goes against it with black mass, we see that demons believe in, even if it's perversely expressed, the demons have, and some of the human confreres of the devil have a greater faith in the real presence, even though it's perversely expressed. So the devil gives us a backhanded compliment. We can count on the devil telling the truth in what he hates.
Tom Nash, I really appreciate you taking the time to do this with us. I've been trying to get you to talk about The Exorcist for years, and now on the 50th anniversary, you finally agreed. Thanks, Tom.
Thank you, brother. Great to be with you and the whole audience.
And thank you, our listener. I hope you do have a very happy Halloween. I'm a Halloween guy, Tom. I like Halloween.
And do you know, I like Halloween.
Do you know
I'm
why
a great
I like
Halloween guy?
Yeah. Here's my deal. This is why I like Halloween. When else through the whole year do people come out into the street and say hello to each other?
And you know what? Last thought, if I may, is you get people as well who are knocking on your door. They knock on your door, Cy. And it's like, and I say back in Steubenville, some people were saying, oh, I'm not going to give dignity to Halloween. It's like, no, it's the Eve of All Saints, All Hallows Eve. Let these people come to your door, these kids, give them candy and say, God bless you, or dress your kids as saints. It's a great opportunity to evangelize, and where you got their attention because you're giving them candy, and where you can send your kids out, hey, who are you? Oh, I'm St. Michael. Who's St. Michael? He defeated the devil. Throw him out. Look at Revelation 12. Great way to evangelize.
Tom,
I'm
thank
all
you.
All over Halloween. All right.
Thank you again very, very much. Thank you to our listeners. Hey, if you have a comment about this episode or any other episode, or you want to suggest a future episode, you can always get in touch with us. focus@catholic.com is our email address, focus@catholic.com. And you can support us by going to givecatholic.com. And wherever you're listening to this podcast, if you would hit the like button, give it 5 stars, please write a few words of a few positive words. All that contributes to growing the podcast. And we'd like to grow the podcast because we'd like fewer and fewer people to be friends with the devil, and more them to be friends with Jesus, who loves each and every one of us. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. The music's getting louder and louder. It must be time for me to go. We'll see you next time, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Focus.